who was the group's undisputed political, social, and spiritual leader, moved the bulk of the membership with him to a jungle settlement in Guyana, South America. There, the People's Temple existed in relative obscurity until November 18, 1978, when four men of a fact-finding party led by Congressman Leo J. Ryan were murdered as they tried to leave Jonestown by plane. Convinced that he would be arrested and implicated in the killings and that the demise of the People's Temple would result, Jones sought to control the end of the temple in his own way. He gathered the entire community around him and issued a call for each person's death in a unified act of self-destruction. The first response was that of a young woman who calmly approached the now famous vat of strawberry-flavored poison, administered one dose to her baby, one to herself, and then sat down in a field, where she and her child died in convulsions within 4 minutes. Others followed steadily in turn. Although a handful of Jonestowners escaped rather than comply, and a few others are reported to have resisted, the survivors claim that the great majority of the 910 people who died did so in an orderly, willful fashion. News of the event shocked us. The broadcast media and the papers provided a barrage of reports, updates, and analyses. For days, our conversations were full of the topic. How many have they found dead now? A guy who escaped says they were drinking the poison like they were hypnotized or something. What were they doing down in South America anyway? It's so hard to believe. What caused it? Yes, what caused it? The critical question. How are we to account for this most astounding of compliant acts? Various explanations have been offered. Some have focused on the charisma of Jim Jones, a man whose style allowed him to be loved like a savior, trusted like a father, and treated like an emperor. Other explanations have pointed to the kind of people who were attracted to the People's Temple. They were mostly poor and uneducated individuals who were willing to give up their freedoms of thought and action for the safety of a place where all decisions would be made for them. Still other explanations have emphasized the quasi-religious nature of the People's Temple, in which unquestioned faith in the cult's leader was assigned highest priority. No doubt each of these features of Jonestown has merit in explaining what happened there. But I do not find them sufficient. After all, the world abounds with cults populated by dependent people who were led by a charismatic figure. What's more, there has never been a shortage of this combination of circumstances in the past. Yet virtually nowhere do we find evidence of an event even approximating the Jonestown incident among such groups. There must be something else that was critical. One especially revealing question gives us a clue. If the community had remained in San Francisco, would Reverend Jim Jones's suicide command have been obeyed? A highly speculative question, to be sure, but the expert most familiar with the People's Temple has no doubt about the answer. Dr. Louis Julian West, chairman of psychiatry and biobehavioral sciences at UCLA, and director of its neuropsychiatric unit, is an authority on cults who had observed the People's Temple for 8 years prior to the Jonestown deaths. When interviewed in the immediate aftermath, he made what strikes me as an inordinately instructive statement. This wouldn't have happened in California, but they lived in total alienation from the rest of the world, in a jungle situation in a hostile country. Although lost in the welter of commentary following the tragedy, Dr. West's observation, together with what we know about the principle of social proof, seems to me quite important to a satisfactory understanding of the compliant suicides. To my mind, the single act in the history of the People's Temple that most contributed to the members' mindless compliance that day occurred a year earlier with the relocation of the temple to a jungled country of unfamiliar customs and strange people. If we are to believe the stories of Jim Jones's malevolent genius, he realized fully the massive psychological impact such a move would have on his followers. All at once, they found themselves in a place they knew nothing about. South America and the rainforests of Guyana, especially, were unlike anything they had experienced in San Francisco. The country, both physical and social, into which they were dropped, must have seemed dreadfully uncertain. Ah, uncertainty, the right-hand man of the principle of social proof. We have already seen that when people are uncertain, they look to the actions of others to guide their own actions. In the alien Guyanese environment, then, temple members were very ready to follow the lead of others. But as we have also seen, it is others of a special kind whose behavior would be most unquestioningly followed, similar others. And therein lies the awful beauty of the Reverend Jim Jones's relocation strategy. In a country like Guyana, there were no similar others for a Jonestown resident but the people of Jonestown itself. What was right for a member of the community was determined to a disproportionate degree by what other community members, influenced heavily by Jones, did and believed. When viewed in this light, the terrible orderliness, the lack of panic, the sense of calm with which these people moved to the vat of poison and to their deaths seems more comprehensible. They hadn't been hypnotized by Jones. They had been convinced, partly by him, but more important, also by the principle of social proof, that suicide was correct conduct. The uncertainty they surely felt upon first hearing the death command must have caused them to look to those around them for a definition of the appropriate response. It is particularly worth noting that they found two impressive pieces of social evidence, each pointing in the same direction. The first was the initial set of their compatriots, who quickly and willingly took the poison drafts. There will always be a few such fanatically obedient individuals in any strong leader-dominated group. Whether in this instance they had been specially instructed beforehand to serve as examples, or whether they were just naturally the most compliant with Jones's wishes, is difficult to know. No matter, the psychological effect of the actions of those individuals must have been potent. If the suicides of similar others in news stories can influence total strangers to kill themselves, imagine how enormously more compelling such an act would be when performed without hesitation by one's neighbors in a place like Jonestown. The second source of social evidence came from the reactions of the crowd itself. Given the conditions, I suspect that what occurred was a large-scale instance of the pluralistic ignorance phenomenon that frequently infects onlookers at emergencies. Each Jonestowner looked to the actions of surrounding individuals to assess the situation, and finding seeming calm because everyone else, too, was surreptitiously assessing rather than reacting, learned that patient turn-taking was the correct behavior. Such misinterpreted but nonetheless, convincing social evidence would be expected to result precisely in the ghastly composure of the assemblage that waited in the tropics of Guyana for business-like death. From my own perspective, most attempts to analyze the Jonestown incident have focused too much on the personal qualities of Jim Jones. Although he was without question a man of rare dynamism, the power he wielded strikes me as coming less from his remarkable personal style than from his understanding of fundamental psychological principles. His real genius as a leader was his realization of the limitations of individual leadership. No leader can hope to persuade, regularly and single-handedly, all the members of the group. A forceful leader can reasonably expect, however, to persuade some sizable proportion of group members. Then the raw information that a substantial number of group members has been convinced can, by itself, convince the rest. Thus, the most influential leaders are those who know how to arrange group conditions to allow the principle of social proof to work maximally in their favor. It is in this that Jones appears to have been inspired. His masterstroke was the decision to move the People's Temple community from its roots in urban San Francisco to the remoteness of equatorial South America, where the conditions of uncertainty and exclusive similarity would make the principle of social proof operate for him as perhaps nowhere else. There, a settlement of 1,000 people, much too large to be held in persistent sway by the force of one man's personality, could be changed from a following into a herd. As slaughterhouse operators have long known, the mentality of a herd makes it easy to manage. Simply get some members moving in the desired direction, and the others, responding not so much to the lead animal as to those immediately surrounding them, will peacefully and mechanically go along. The powers of the amazing Reverend Jim Jones, then, are probably best understood not in terms of his dramatic personal style, but in his profound knowledge of the art of social jiu-jitsu. How to Say No. This chapter began with an account of the relatively harmless practice of laugh tracking and has moved on to stories of murder and suicide, all explained by the principle of social proof. How can we expect to defend ourselves against a weapon of influence that pervades such a vast range of behavior? The difficulty is compounded by the realization that most of the time, we don't want to guard against the information that social proof provides. The evidence it offers about how we should act is usually valid and valuable. With it, we can cruise confidently through a myriad of decisions without personally having to investigate the detailed pros and cons of each. In this sense, the principle of social proof equips us with a wonderful kind of automatic pilot device, not unlike that aboard most aircraft. Yet there are occasional but real problems with automatic pilots. These problems appear whenever the flight information locked into the control mechanism is wrong. In these instances, we will be taken off course. Depending on the size of the error, the consequences can be severe. But because the automatic pilot afforded by the principle of social proof is more often an ally than an enemy, we can't be expected to want simply to disconnect it. Thus, we are faced with a classic problem: how to make use of a piece of equipment that simultaneously benefits and imperils our welfare. Fortunately, there is a way out of the dilemma. Because the disadvantages of automatic pilots arise principally when incorrect data have been put into the control system, our best defense against these disadvantages is to recognize when the data are in error. If we can become sensitive to situations where the social proof automatic pilot is working with inaccurate information, we can disengage the mechanism and grasp the controls when we need to. There are two types of situation in which incorrect data cause the principle of social proof to give us poor counsel. The first occurs when the social evidence has been purposely falsified. Invariably, these situations are manufactured by exploiters intent on creating the impression, reality be damned, that a multitude is performing the way the exploiters want us to perform. The canned laughter of TV comedy shows, which we have already discussed, is one variety of faked data of this sort. But there is a great deal more, and much of the fakery is strikingly obvious. For instance, canned responses are not unique to the electronic media, or even to the electronic age. In fact, the heavy-handed exploitation of the principle of social proof can be traced through the history of one of our most venerable art forms, grand opera. This is the phenomenon called clacking, said to have been begun in 1820 by a pair of Paris opera house habitués named Sautant and Porcher. The men were more than opera-goers, though. They were businessmen whose product was applause. Organizing under the title L'Assurance des Succès Dramatiques, they leased themselves and their employees to singers and opera managers who wished to be assured of an appreciative audience response. So effective were they in stimulating genuine audience reaction with their rigged reactions that before long, claques, usually consisting of a leader, chef de claque, and several individual claqueurs, had become an established and persistent tradition throughout the world of opera. As music historian Robert Sabin notes, by 1830 the claque was a full-bloom institution, collecting by day, applauding by night, all in the honest open. But it is altogether probable that neither Sautant nor his ally Porcher had a notion of the extent to which their scheme of paid applause would be adopted and applied wherever opera is sung. As clacking grew and developed, its practitioners offered an array of styles and strengths. In the same way that laugh track producers can hire individuals who excel in titters, chuckles, or belly laughs, the clacks spawned their own specialists, the pleureuses, chosen for their ability to weep on cue, the bisseurs, who called bis, repeat, and encore in ecstatic tones, and in direct kinship with today's laugh track performer, the rieur, selected for the infectious quality of his laugh. For our purposes, though, the most instructive parallel to modern forms of canned response is the conspicuous character of the fakery. No special need was seen to disguise or vary the clack, who often sat in the same seats, performance after performance, year after year, led by a chef de clack 2 decades into his position. Even the monetary transactions were not hidden from the public. Indeed, 100 years after the birth of clacking, a reader of the London Musical Times could scan the advertised rates of the Italian claqueurs. Whether in the world of Rigoletto or Gilligan's Island, then, audiences have been successfully manipulated by those who use social evidence, even when that evidence has been openly falsified. Advertised rates of the Italian clack. For applause on entrance, if a gentleman, 25 lira. For applause on entrance, if a lady, 15 lira. Ordinary applause during performance, each 10 lira. Insistent applause during performance, each 15 lira. Still more insistent applause, 17 lira. For interruptions with bene or bravo, 5 lira. For a bis at any cost, 50 lira. Wild enthusiasm, a special sum to be arranged. From ordinary applause to wild enthusiasm, claqueurs offered their services in an audaciously public fashion. In this case, in a newspaper read by many of the audience members they fully expected to influence. Clack, whirr. What Sautant and Porcher realized about the mechanical way that we abide by the principle of social proof is understood as well by a variety of today's exploiters. They see no need to hide the manufactured nature of the social evidence they provide. Witness the amateurish quality of the average TV laugh track. They seem almost smug in the recognition of our predicament. Either we must allow them to fool us, or we must abandon the precious automatic pilots that make us so vulnerable to their tricks. But in their certainty that they have us trapped, such exploiters have made a crucial mistake. The laxity with which they construct phony social evidence gives us a way to fight back. Because automatic pilots can be engaged and disengaged at will, we can cruise along, trusting in the course steered by the principle of social proof, until we recognize that a piece of inaccurate data is being used. Then we can take the controls, make the necessary correction for the misinformation, and reset the automatic pilot. The transparency of the rigged social proof we get these days provides us with exactly the cue we need for knowing when to perform this simple maneuver. With no more cost than a bit of vigilance for plainly counterfeit social evidence, then, we can protect ourselves nicely. Let's take an example. A bit earlier, we noted the proliferation of average person on the street ads, in which a number of ordinary people speak glowingly of a product, often without knowing that their words are being recorded. As would be expected according to the principle of social proof, these testimonials from average people like you and me make for quite effective advertising campaigns. They have always included one relatively subtle kind of distortion. We hear only from those who like the product. As a result, we get an understandably biased picture of the amount of social support for it. More recently, though, a cruder and more unethical sort of falsification has been introduced. Commercial producers often don't bother to get genuine testimonials. They merely hire actors to play the roles of average people testifying in an unrehearsed fashion to an interviewer. It is amazing how bald-faced these unrehearsed interview commercials can be. The situations are obviously staged. The participants are clearly actors, and the dialogue is unmistakably pre-written. Recently, I was watching TV and a commercial came on, and the announcer, in a tone of voice usually reserved for major developments in the Persian Gulf, said, "Now consumers can ask Angela Lansbury their questions about Bufferin." As a normal human, The natural reaction to this announcement is, huh? Meaning, what does Angela Lansbury have to do with Bufferin? But this commercial featured several consumers who had apparently been stopped at random on the street, and every one of them had a question for Angela Lansbury about Bufferin. Basically, what they asked was, Miss Lansbury, is Bufferin a good product that I should purchase, or what? These consumers seemed very earnest. It was as if they had been going around for months, wringing their hands and saying, I have a question about Bufferin. If only I could ask Angela Lansbury. What we are seeing here is yet another example of a worsening problem that has been swept under the rug for too long in this nation. The invasion of consumers from Mars. They look like humans, but they don't act like humans, and they are taking over. I know that whenever I encounter an influence attempt of this sort, it sets off in me a kind of alarm with a clear directive. Attention, attention, bad social proof in this situation, temporarily disconnect automatic pilot. It's so easy to do. We need only make a conscious decision to be alert to counterfeit social evidence. And the smug overconfidence of the exploiters will play directly into our hands. We can relax until their manifest fakery is spotted, at which time we can pounce. And we should pounce with a vengeance. I am speaking here of more than simply ignoring the misinformation, although this defensive tactic is certainly called for. I am speaking of aggressive counterattack. Whenever possible, we ought to sting those responsible for the rigging of social evidence. We should purchase no products featured in phony, unrehearsed interview commercials. Moreover, each manufacturer of the items should receive a letter explaining our response and recommending that they discontinue use of the advertising agency that produced so deceptive a presentation of their product. Of course, we don't always want to trust the actions of others to direct our conduct, especially in a situation important enough to warrant our personal investigation of the pros and cons, or in which we are experts. But we do want to be able to count on others' behavior as a source of valid information in a large array of settings. If, in such settings, we find that we cannot trust the information to be valid because someone has tampered with the evidence, we ought to be ready to strike back. In such instances, I personally feel driven by more than the aversion to being duped. I bristle at the thought of being pushed into an unacceptable corner by those who would undermine one of my hedges against the decisional overload of modern life. And I get a genuine sense of righteousness by lashing out when they try. If you are like me, so should you. In addition to the times when social evidence is deliberately faked, there is another time when the principle of social proof will regularly steer us wrong. In such an instance, an innocent natural error will produce snowballing social proof that pushes us to the incorrect decision. The pluralist ignorance phenomenon, in which everyone at an emergency sees no cause for alarm, is one example of this process. The best illustration I know, however, comes from a story of one of my students, who was a highway patrolman. After a class session in which the subject of discussion was the principle of social proof, he stayed to talk with me. He said that he now understood the cause of a type of traffic accident that has always puzzled him before. The accident typically occurred on the city freeway during rush hour, when cars in all lanes were moving steadily but slowly. Events leading to the accident would start when a pair of cars, one behind the other, would simultaneously begin signaling an intention to get out of the lane they were in and into the next. Within seconds, a long line of drivers to the rear of the first two would follow suit, thinking that something, a stalled car or a construction barrier, was blocking the lane ahead. It would be in this crush to cram into the available spaces of the next lane that a collision frequently happened. The odd thing about it all, according to the patrolman, was that very often there had been no obstruction to be avoided in the first place. And by the time of the accident, this should have been obvious to anyone who looked. He said he had more than once witnessed such accidents when there was a visibly clear road in front of the ill-fated lane switchers. The patrolman's account provides certain insights into the way we respond to social proof. First, we seem to assume that if a lot of people are doing the same thing, They must know something we don't. Especially when we are uncertain, we are willing to place an enormous amount of trust in the collective knowledge of the crowd. Second, quite frequently the crowd is mistaken because they are not acting on the basis of any superior information, but are reacting, themselves, to the principle of social proof. So, if a pair of freeway drivers decided by coincidence to change lanes at the identical moment, the next two drivers might well do the same, assuming that the forward drivers had spotted an obstruction. The resulting social evidence confronting drivers behind this group would be potent. Four successive cars, all with their turn signals flashing, trying to angle into the next lane. More signal lights would go on. The social proof would be undeniable by then. For drivers to the rear, there could be no question about the correctness of switching lanes. All those guys ahead must know something. So intent would they be upon working themselves into the next lane that, without even checking the true condition of the road before them, the drivers would begin a line-long flank assault. Crash. There is a lesson here. An automatic pilot device, like social proof, should never be trusted fully. Even when no saboteur has fed bad information into the mechanism, it can sometimes go haywire by itself. We need to check the machine from time to time to be sure that it hasn't worked itself out of sync with the other sources of evidence in the situation. The objective facts, our prior experiences, our own judgments. Fortunately, this precaution requires neither much effort nor much time. A quick glance around is all that is needed, and this little precaution is well worth it. The consequences of single-minded reliance on social evidence can be frightening. This aspect of the social proof phenomenon always reminds me of the way certain Indian tribes, the Blackfeet, Cree, Snake, and Crow, used to hunt the North American buffalo. There are two features of buffalo that make them especially susceptible to erroneous social evidence. First, their eyes are set on their heads so that it is easier for them to see to the side than to the front. Second, when they run, as in a stampede, it is with their heads down low so they cannot see above the herd. As a result, the Indians realized it was possible to kill tremendous numbers of buffalo by starting a herd running toward a cliff. The animals responding to the thundering social proof around them and never looking up to see what lay ahead did the rest. One astonished observer to such a hunt described the deadly outcome of the buffalo's obsessive trust in collective knowledge. In this way, it was possible to decoy a herd toward a precipice and cause it to plunge over en masse, the leaders being thrust over by their followers, and all the rest following of their own free will. Certainly a flyer whose plane is locked onto automatic pilot would be wise to glance occasionally at the instrument panel and out the window. In the same way, we need to look up and around periodically whenever we are locked onto the evidence of the crowd. Without this simple safeguard against misguided social proof, our prospects might well run parallel to those of the freeway lane switchers and the North American buffalo. Crash. Reader's report from a former racetrack employee. I became aware of one method of faking social evidence to one's advantage while working at a racetrack. In order to lower the odds and make more money, some bettors are able to sway the public to bet on bad horses. Odds at a racetrack are based on where the money is being bet. The more money on a horse, the lower, better the odds. Many people who play the horses have surprisingly little knowledge of racing or betting strategy. Thus, especially when they don't know much about the horses in a particular race, a lot of times they'll simply bet the favorite. Because tote boards are displayed with up-to-the-minute odds, the public can always tell who the current favorite is. The system that a high roller can use to alter the odds is actually quite simple. The guy has in mind a horse he feels has a good chance of winning. Next, he chooses a horse that has long odds, say 15-1, and doesn't have a realistic chance to win. The minute the mutual windows open, the guy puts down $100 on the inferior horse, creating an instant favorite whose odds on the board drop to about 2-1. Now the elements of social proof begin to work. People who are uncertain of how to bet the race look to the tote board to see which horse the early bettors have decided is a favorite, and they follow. A snowballing effect now occurs as other people continue to bet the favorite. At this point, the high roller can go back to the window and bet heavily on his true favorite, which will have better odds now because the new favorite has pushed down the board. If the guy wins, the initial $100 investment will have been worth it many times over. I've seen this happen myself. I remember one time a person put down $100 on a pre-race 10-to-1 shot, making it the early favorite. The rumors started circulating around the track. People knew something. Next thing you know, everyone, me included, was betting on this horse. It ended up running last and had a bad leg. Many people lost a lot of money. Somebody came out ahead, though. We'll never know who, but he is the one with all the money. He understood the theory of social proof. Once again, we can see that social proof is most powerful for those who feel unfamiliar or unsure in a specific situation, and who, consequently, must look outside of themselves for evidence of how best to behave there. Chapter 5. Liking. The Friendly Thief. The main work of a trial attorney is to make a jury like his client, Clarence Darrow. Few people would be surprised to learn that, as a rule, we most prefer to say yes to the requests of someone we know and like. What might be startling to note, however, is that this simple rule is used in hundreds of ways by total strangers to get us to comply with their requests. The clearest illustration I know of the professional exploitation of the liking rule is the Tupperware party, which I consider the quintessential American compliance setting. Anybody familiar with the workings of a Tupperware party will recognize the use of the various weapons of influence we have examined so far. Reciprocity. To start, games are played and prizes won by the partygoers. Anyone who doesn't win a prize gets to reach into a grab bag for hers so that everyone has received a gift before the buying begins. Commitment. Each participant is urged to describe publicly the uses and benefits she has found in the Tupperware she already owns. And social proof. Once the buying begins, each purchase builds the idea that other similar people want the product. Therefore, it must be good. All the major weapons of influence are present to help things along. But the real power of the Tupperware party comes from a particular arrangement that trades on the liking rule. Despite the entertaining and persuasive salesmanship of the Tupperware demonstrator, the true request to purchase the product does not come from this stranger. It comes from a friend to every woman in the room. Oh, the Tupperware representative may physically ask for each partygoer's order, all right, but the more psychologically compelling requester is a housewife sitting off to the side, smiling, chatting, and serving refreshments. She is the party hostess, who has called her friends together for the demonstration in her home, and who everyone knows makes a profit from each piece sold at her party. Simple. By providing the hostess with a percentage of the take, the Tupperware Home Parties Corporation arranges for its customers to buy from and for a friend rather than an unknown salesperson. In this way, the attraction, the warmth, the security, and the obligation of friendship are brought to bear on the sales setting. Consumer researchers Frenzer and Davis, who have examined the social ties between the hostess and the partygoers in home party sales settings, have affirmed the power of the company's approach. The strength of that social bond is twice as likely to determine product purchase as is preference for the product itself. The results have been remarkable. It was recently estimated that Tupperware sales exceed $2.5 million a day. What is interesting is that the customers appear to be fully aware of the liking and friendship pressures embodied in the Tupperware party. Some don't seem to mind. Others do, but don't seem to know how to avoid them. One woman I spoke with described her reactions with more than a bit of frustration in her voice. It's gotten to the point now where I hate to be invited to Tupperware parties. I've got all the containers I need. And if I wanted any more, I could buy another brand cheaper in the store. But when a friend calls up, I feel like I have to go. And when I get there, I feel like I have to buy something. What can I do? It's for one of my friends. With so irresistible an ally as the friendship principle operating, it is little wonder that the company has abandoned retail sales outlets and has pushed the home party concept until a Tupperware party now starts somewhere every 2.7 seconds. But of course, All sorts of other compliance professionals recognize the pressure to say yes to someone we know and like. Take, for instance, the growing number of charity organizations that recruit volunteers to canvass for donations close to their own homes. They understand perfectly how much more difficult it is for us to turn down a charity request when it comes from a friend or a neighbor. Other compliance professionals have found that the friend doesn't even have to be present to be effective. Often, just the mention of the friend's name is enough. The Shackley Corporation, which specializes in door-to-door sales of various home-related products, advises its salespeople to use the endless chain method for finding new customers. Once a customer admits to liking a product, he or she can be pressed for the names of friends who would also appreciate learning about it. The individuals on that list can then be approached for sales and a list of their friends who can serve as sources for still other potential customers and so on in an endless chain. The key to the success of this method is that each new prospect is visited by a salesperson armed with the name of a friend who suggested I call on you. Turning the salesperson away under those circumstances is difficult. It's almost like rejecting the friend. The Shackley Sales Manual insists that employees use this system without fail. It would be impossible to overestimate its value. Phoning or calling on a prospect and being able to say that Mr. So-and-so, a friend of his, felt he would benefit by giving you a few moments of his time is virtually as good as a sale 50% made before you enter. The widespread use by compliance practitioners of the liking bond between friends tells us much about the power of the liking rule to produce assent. In fact, we find that such professionals seek to benefit from the rule even when already formed friendships are not present for them to employ. Under these circumstances, the professional's compliance strategy is quite direct. They first get us to like them. There is a man in Detroit, Joe Girard, who specialized in using the liking rule to sell Chevrolets. He became wealthy in the process, making more than $200,000 a year. With such a salary, we might guess that he was a high-level GM executive or perhaps the owner of a Chevrolet dealership. But no, he made his money as a salesman on the showroom floor. At what he did, he was phenomenal. For 12 years straight, he won the title as the number one car salesman. He averaged more than 5 cars and trucks sold every day he worked. And he has been called the world's greatest car salesman by the Guinness Book of World Records. For all his success, the formula he employed was surprisingly simple. It consisted of offering people just two things, a fair price and someone they liked to buy from. And that's it, he claimed in an interview. Finding the salesman they like, plus the price, put them both together, and you get a deal. Fine. The Joe Girard formula tells us how vital the liking rule is to his business, but it doesn't tell us nearly enough. For one thing, it doesn't tell us why customers liked him more than some other salesperson who offered a fair price. There is a crucial and fascinating general question that Joe's formula leaves unanswered. What are the factors that cause one person to like another person? If we knew that answer, we would be a long way toward understanding how people such as Joe can so successfully arrange to have us like them, and conversely, how we might successfully arrange to have others like us. Fortunately, social scientists have been asking the question for decades. Their accumulated evidence has allowed them to identify a number of factors that reliably cause liking. And as we will see, each is cleverly used by compliance professionals to urge us along the road to yes. Physical attractiveness. Although it is generally acknowledged that good-looking people have an advantage in social interaction, recent findings indicate that we may have sorely underestimated the size and reach of that advantage. There seems to be a click-whir response to attractive people. Like all click-whir reactions, it happens automatically without forethought. The response itself falls into a category that social scientists call halo effects. A halo effect occurs when one positive characteristic of a person dominates the way that person is viewed by others. And the evidence is now clear that physical attractiveness is often such a characteristic. Research has shown that we automatically assign to good-looking individuals such favorable traits as talent, kindness, honesty, and intelligence. Furthermore, we make these judgments without being aware that physical attractiveness plays a role in the process. Certain of the consequences of this unconscious assumption that good-looking equals good scare me. For example, a study of the Canadian federal elections found that attractive candidates received more than 2.5 times as many votes as unattractive candidates. Despite such evidence of favoritism toward handsome politicians, follow-up research demonstrated that voters do not realize their bias. In fact, 73% of Canadian voters surveyed denied in the strongest possible terms that their votes had been influenced by physical appearance. Only 14% even allowed for the possibility of such influence. A similar effect has been found in hiring situations. In one study, good grooming of applicants in a simulated employment interview accounted for more favorable hiring decisions than did job qualifications. This, even though the interviewers claimed that appearance played a small role in their choices. Equally unsettling research indicates that our judicial process is similarly susceptible to the influences of body dimensions and bone structure. Good-looking people are likely to receive highly favorable treatment in the legal system. For example, in a Pennsylvania study, researchers rated the physical attractiveness of 74 separate male defendants at the start of their criminal trials. When much later the researchers checked court records for the results of these cases, they found that the handsome men had received significantly lighter sentences. In fact, the attractive defendants were twice as likely to avoid jail as the unattractive ones. In another study, this one on the damages awarded in a staged negligence trial, a defendant who was better looking than his victim was assessed an average amount of $5,623. But when the victim was the more attractive of the two, the average compensation was $10,051. What's more, both male and female jurors exhibited the attractiveness-based favoritism. Other experiments have demonstrated that attractive people are more likely to obtain help when in need and are more persuasive in changing the opinions of an audience. Here, too, both sexes respond in the same way. In the helping study, for instance, the better-looking men and women received aid more often, even from members of their own sex. A major exception to this rule might be expected to occur, of course, if the attractive person is viewed as a direct competitor, especially a romantic rival. Short of this qualification, though, it is apparent that good-looking people enjoy an enormous social advantage in our culture. They are better liked, more persuasive, more frequently helped, and seen as possessing better personality traits and intellectual capacities. And it appears that the social benefits of good looks begin to accumulate quite early. Research on elementary school children shows that adults view aggressive acts as less naughty when performed by an attractive child, and that teachers presume good-looking children to be more intelligent than their less attractive classmates. It is hardly any wonder, then, that the halo of physical attractiveness is regularly exploited by compliance professionals. Because we like attractive people, and because we tend to comply with those we like, it makes sense that sales training programs include grooming hints, that fashionable clothiers select their floor staffs from among the good-looking candidates, and that con men are handsome, and con women pretty. Similarity. But what if physical appearance is not much at issue? After all, most people possess average looks. Are there other factors that can be used to produce liking? As both researchers and compliance professionals know, there are several, and one of the most influential is similarity. We like people who are similar to us. This fact seems to hold true whether the similarity is in the area of opinions, personality traits, background, or lifestyle. Consequently, those who wish to be liked in order to increase our compliance can accomplish that purpose by appearing similar to us in any of a wide variety of ways. Dress is a good example. Several studies have demonstrated that we are more likely to help those who dress like us. In one study done in the early 1970s when young people tended to dress either in hippie or straight fashion, experimenters donned hippie or straight attire and asked college students on campus for a dime to make a phone call. When the experimenter was dressed in the same way as the student, the request was granted in more than two-thirds of the instances. But when the student and requester were dissimilarly dressed, the dime was provided less than half the time. Another experiment shows how automatic our positive response to similar others can be. Marchers in an anti-war demonstration were found to be not only more likely to sign the petition of a similarly dressed requester, but also to do so without bothering to read it first. Click, whir. Another way requesters can manipulate similarity to increase liking and compliance is to claim that they have backgrounds and interests similar to ours. Car salesmen, for example, are trained to look for evidence of such things while examining the customer's trade-in. If there is camping gear in the trunk, the salesman might mention later on how he loves to get away from the city whenever he can. If there are golf balls in the back seat, he might remark that he hopes the rain will hold off until he can play the 18 holes he has scheduled for later in the day. If he notices that the car was purchased out of state, he might ask where the customer is from and report with surprise that he or his wife was born there too. As trivial as these similarities may seem, they appear to work. One researcher who examined the sales records of insurance companies found that customers were more likely to buy insurance when the salesperson was like them in such areas as age, religion, politics, and cigarette smoking habits. Because even small similarities can be effective in producing a positive response to another, and because a veneer of similarity can be so easily manufactured, I would advise special caution in the presence of requesters who claim to be just like you. Indeed, it would be wise these days to be careful around salespeople who just seem to be just like you. Many sales training programs now urge trainees to mirror and match the customer's body posture, mood, and verbal style, as similarities along each of these dimensions have been shown to lead to positive results. Compliments. Actor McLean Stevenson once described how his wife tricked him into marriage. She said she liked me. Although designed for a laugh, the remark is as much instructive as humorous. The information that someone fancies us can be a bewitchingly effective device for producing return liking and willing compliance. So, often in terms of flattery or simple claims of affinity, we hear positive estimation from people who want something from us. Remember Joe Girard, the world's greatest car salesman, who says the secret of his success was getting customers to like him? He did something that, on the face of it, seems foolish and costly. Each month, he sent every one of his more than 13,000 former customers a holiday greeting card containing a personal message. The holiday greeting changed from month to month, Happy New Year or Happy Thanksgiving, etc., but the message printed on the face of the card never varied. It read, "I like you." As Joe explained it, "There's nothing else on the card, nothing but my name. I'm just telling them that I like them." "I like you." It came in the mail every year, 12 times a year, like clockwork. "I like you" on a printed card that went off to 13,000 other people, too. Could a statement of liking so impersonal, so obviously designed to sell cars, really work? Joe Girard thinks so. And a man as successful as he was at what he did deserves our attention. Joe understands an important fact about human nature. We are phenomenal suckers for flattery. Although there are limits to our gullibility, especially when we can be sure that the flatterer is trying to manipulate us, we tend, as a rule, to believe praise and to like those who provide it, oftentimes when it is clearly false. An experiment done on men in North Carolina shows how helpless we can be in the face of praise. The men in the study received comments about themselves from another person who needed a favor from them. Some of the men got only positive comments, some got only negative comments, and some got a mixture of good and bad. There were three interesting findings. First, the evaluator who provided only praise was liked best by the men. Second, This was the case even though the men fully realized that the flatterer stood to gain from their liking him. Finally, unlike the other types of comments, pure praise did not have to be accurate to work. Positive comments produced just as much liking for the flatterer when they were untrue as when they were true. Apparently, we have such an automatically positive reaction to compliments that we can fall victim to someone who uses them in an obvious attempt to win our favor. Click, whir. When seen in this light, the expensive printing and mailing well over 150,000 I Like You cards each year seems neither as foolish nor as costly as before. Contact and cooperation. For the most part, we like things that are familiar to us. To prove the point to yourself, try a little experiment. Get the negative of an old photograph that shows a front view of your face and have it developed into a pair of pictures. One that shows you as you actually look and one that shows a reverse image, so that the right and left sides of your face are interchanged. Now decide which version of your face you like better and ask a good friend to make the choice too. If you were at all like a group of Milwaukee women on whom this procedure was tried, you should notice something odd. Your friend will prefer the true you, but you will prefer the reverse image. Why? Because you both will be responding favorably to the more familiar face. Your friend, the one the world sees, and you to the transposed one you find in the mirror every day. Because of its effect on liking, familiarity plays a role in decisions about all sorts of things, including the politicians we elect. It appears that in an election booth, voters often choose a candidate merely because the name seems familiar. In one controversial Ohio election a few years ago, a man given little chance of winning the state attorney general race swept to victory when, shortly before the election, he changed his name to Brown, a family name of much Ohio political tradition. How could such a thing happen? The answer lies partially in the unconscious way that familiarity affects liking. Often we don't realize that our attitude toward something has been influenced by the number of times we have been exposed to it in the past. For example, in one experiment, the faces of several individuals were flashed on a screen so quickly that later on, the subjects who were exposed to the faces in this manner couldn't recall having seen any of them before. Yet, the more frequently a person's face was flashed on the screen, the more these subjects came to like that person when they met in a subsequent interaction. And because greater liking leads to greater social influence, these subjects were also more persuaded by the opinion statements of the individuals whose faces had appeared on the screen most frequently. On the basis of evidence that we are more favorable toward the things we have had contact with, some people have recommended a contact approach to improving race relations. They argue that simply by providing individuals of different ethnic background with more exposure to one another as equals, those individuals will naturally come to like each other better. However, when scientists have examined school integration, the area offering the single best test of the contact approach, they have discovered quite the opposite pattern. School desegregation is more likely to increase prejudice between blacks and whites than to decrease it. Let's stay with the issue of school desegregation for a while. However well-intentioned the proponents of interracial harmony through simple contact, their approach is unlikely to bear fruit because the argument on which it is based is terribly misinformed. First of all, the school setting is no melting pot where children interact as readily with members of other ethnic groups as they do with their own. Years after formal school integration, there is little social integration. The students clot together ethnically, separating themselves for the most part from other groups. Second, even if there were much more inter-ethnic interaction, research shows that becoming familiar with something through repeated contact doesn't necessarily cause greater liking. In fact, continued exposure to a person or object under unpleasant conditions, such as frustration, conflict, or competition, leads to less liking. And the typical American classroom fosters precisely these unpleasant conditions. Consider the illuminating report of a psychologist, Elliot Aronson, called in to consult with school authorities on problems in the Austin, Texas schools. His description of how he found education proceeding in the standard classroom could apply to nearly any public school in the United States. In general, here is how it works. The teacher stands in front of the class and asks a question. 6 to 10 children strain in their seats and wave their hands in the teacher's face, eager to be called on and show how smart they are. Several others sit quietly with eyes averted, trying to become invisible. When the teacher calls on one child, you see looks of disappointment and dismay on the faces of the eager students, who missed a chance to get the teacher's approval. And you will see relief on the faces of the others who didn't know the answer. This game is fiercely competitive, and the stakes are high, because the kids are competing for the love and approval of one of the 2 or 3 most important people in their world. Further, this teaching process guarantees that the children will not learn to like and understand each other. Conjure up your own experience. If you knew the right answer and the teacher called on someone else, you probably hoped that he or she would make a mistake so that you would have a chance to display your knowledge. If you were called on and failed, or if you didn't even raise your hand to compete, you probably envied and resented your classmates who knew the answer. Children who fail in the system become jealous and resentful of the successes, putting them down as teachers' pets or even resorting to violence against them in the schoolyard. The successful students, for their part, often hold the unsuccessful children in contempt, calling them dumb or stupid. This competitive process does not encourage anyone to look benevolently and happily upon his fellow students. Should we wonder, then, why raw school desegregation, whether by enforced busing, district rezoning, or school closures, so frequently produces increased rather than decreased prejudice? When our own children find their pleasant social and friendship contacts within their own ethnic boundaries and get repeated exposure to other groups only in the competitive cauldron of the classroom, we might expect as much. Are there available solutions to this problem? One possibility might be to end our attempts at school integration, but that hardly seems workable. Even were we to ignore the inevitable legal and constitutional challenges and the disruptive societal wrangle such a retreat would provoke, there are solid reasons for pursuing classroom integration. For instance, although white students' achievement levels remain steady, it is 10 times more likely that the academic performance of minority students will significantly increase rather than significantly decline after desegregation. We must be cautious in our approach to school desegregation, not to throw out the baby because it is sitting in some dirty bathwater. The idea, of course, is to jettison just the water, leaving the baby shining from the bath. Right now, though, our baby is soaking in the schmutzwasser of increased racial hostility. Fortunately, real hope for draining away that hostility is emerging from the research of education specialists into the concept of cooperative learning. Because much of the heightened prejudice from classroom desegregation seems to stem from increased exposure to outside group members as rivals, these educators have experimented with forms of learning in which cooperation rather than competition with classmates is central. Off to camp. To understand the logic of the cooperative approach, it helps to re-examine the fascinating 3-decades-old research program of Turkish-born social scientist Muzaffer Sherif. Intrigued with the issue of intergroup conflict, Sherif decided to investigate the process as it developed in boys' summer camps. Although the boys never realized that they were participants in an experiment, Sherif and his associates consistently engaged in artful manipulations of the camp's social environment to observe the effects on group relations. It didn't take much to bring on certain kinds of ill will. Simply separating the boys into 2 residence cabins was enough to stimulate a we versus they feeling between the groups, and assigning names to the 2 groups, the Eagles and the Rattlers, accelerated the sense of rivalry. The boys soon began to demean the qualities and accomplishments of the other group. But these forms of hostility were minor compared to what occurred when the experimenters purposely introduced competitive activities into the factions' meetings with one another. cabin against cabin treasure hunts, tugs of war, and athletic contests produced name-calling and physical friction. During the competitions, members of the opposing team were labeled cheaters, sneaks, and stinkers. Afterward, cabins were raided, rival banners were stolen and burned, threatening signs were posted, and lunchroom scuffles were commonplace. At this point, it was evident to Sharif that the recipe for disharmony was quick and easy. Just separate the participants into groups and let sit for a while in their own juices. They mix together over the flame of continued competition, and there you have it, cross-group hatred at a rolling boil. A more challenging issue then faced the experimenters, how to remove the entrenched hostility they had created. They first tried the contact approach of bringing the bands together more often. But even when the joint activities were pleasant ones, such as movies and social events, the results were disastrous. Picnics produced food fights. Entertainment programs gave way to shouting contests. Dining hall lines degenerated into shoving matches. Sharif and his research team began to worry that, in Dr. Frankenstein fashion, they might have created a monster they could no longer control. Then, at the height of the strife, they hit on a resolution that was at once simple and effective. They constructed a series of situations in which competition between the groups would have harmed everyone's interests, in which cooperation was necessary for mutual benefit. On a day-long outing, the single truck available to go into town for food was found to be stuck. The boys were assembled and all pulled and pushed together until the vehicle was on its way. In another instance, the researchers arranged for an interruption of the camp's water supply, which came through pipes from a distant tank. Presented with the common crisis and realizing the need for unified action, the boys organized themselves harmoniously to find and fix the problem before day's end. And yet another circumstance requiring cooperation, the campers were informed that a desirable movie was available for rental, but that the camp could not afford it. Aware that the only solution was to combine resources, the boys rented the film with pooled money and spent an unusually congenial evening enjoying it together. The consequences, though not instantaneous, were nonetheless striking. Conjoint efforts toward common goals steadily bridged the rancorous rift between the groups. Before long, the verbal baiting had died, the jostling in lines had ended, and the boys had begun to intermix at the meal tables. Further, when asked to list their best friends, significant numbers changed from an earlier exclusive naming of in-group chums to a listing that included boys in the other group. Some even thanked the researchers for the opportunity to rate their friends again because they realized they had changed their minds since the old days. In one revealing episode, the boys were returning from a campfire on a single bus, something that would have produced bedlam before but was now specifically requested by the boys. When the bus stopped at a refreshment stand, the boys of one group, with $5 left in its treasury, decided to treat their former bitter adversaries to milkshakes. We can trace the roots of this surprising turnabout to those times when the boys had to view one another as allies instead of opponents. The crucial procedure was the experimenters' imposition of common goals on the groups. It was the cooperation required to achieve these goals that finally allowed the rival group members to experience one another as reasonable fellows, valued helpers and friends. And when success resulted from the mutual efforts, it became especially difficult to maintain feelings of hostility toward those who had been teammates in the triumph. Back to school. In the welter of racial tensions that followed school desegregation, certain educational psychologists began to see the relevance to the classroom in Sharif's findings. If only the learning experience there could be modified to include at least occasional inter-ethnic cooperation toward mutual successes, perhaps cross-group friendships would have a place to grow. Although similar projects have been underway in various states, an especially interesting approach in this direction, termed the Jigsaw Classroom, was developed by Elliot Aronson and his colleagues in Texas and California. The essence of the jigsaw route to learning is to require that students work together to master the material scheduled for an upcoming examination. This is accomplished by forming students into cooperating teams and giving each student only one part of the information, one piece of the puzzle necessary to pass the test. Under this system, the students must take turns teaching and helping one another. Everyone needs everyone else to do well. Like Sharif's campers working on tasks that could be successfully accomplished only conjointly, the students became allies rather than enemies. When tried in recently desegregated classrooms, the jigsaw approach has generated impressive results. Studies have shown that compared to other classrooms in the same school using the traditional competitive method, jigsaw learning stimulated significantly more friendship and less prejudice between ethnic groups. Besides this vital reduction in hostility, there were other advantages. Self-esteem, liking for school, and test scores improved for minority students. And the white students benefited too. Their self-esteem and liking for school went up, and their test performance was at least as high as that of whites in the traditional classes. Gains such as these cry out for more detailed explanation. What exactly goes on in the jigsaw classroom to account for effects we had long ago lost hope of attaining in the public schools? A case study provided by Aronson helps us to understand better. It relates the experience of Carlos, a young Mexican-American boy, who found himself in a jigsaw group for the first time. Carlos's job was to learn and then convey to his team information on the middle years of Joseph Pulitzer. A test on the famous newspaperman's life would soon face each group member. Aronson tells what happened. Carlos was not very articulate in English, his second language, and because he was often ridiculed when he had spoken up in the past, he had learned over the years to keep quiet in class. We might even say that Carlos and the teacher had entered into a conspiracy of silence. He would become anonymous, buried in the bustle of classroom activity, and not be embarrassed by having to stumble over answers. She, in turn, would not call on him. Her decision probably came from the purest of motives. She didn't want to humiliate him or watch the other kids make fun.